Bill had the trophy.
This is tape number four, the morning of September the 17th. The president, no, it's Hillman, president. Well, why don't we go into a little bit more of the personality as he sees it? I think that's the important thing.
Would you draw as much as you can without straining it? What difficulties did he have? What difficulties did he have in his personality?
I'm absolutely certain that he had the same difficulties that other presidents had when they were trying to get things done for the welfare, what they thought was the welfare of the country. He was viciously attacked in the press of that day on nearly every decision that he made. But it didn't jar him, because he thought he was doing right and he was willing to try to carry it through, and as long as he got the proper support in the Congress, he did carry it through. He was a good executive, but I don't think he was the hard-boiled person that we look at, except in his military career. He was the commanding general and he acted as the commanding general, I think, as a president. He acted as the servant of the people, and that's the reason he made these tours around over the country, to let people know what he wanted and why he wanted it, and gave them the chance, whenever they wanted to ask him the questions about the various things. I'm sure of that.
Well, there must have been a very great strain of diplomacy in him, because, first of all, he presided at this Constitutional Convention, didn't he?
Yes.
And also, as I recall, George Marshall called him once one of the great generals of the world, not so much because of military victories, but because of the necessity of talking and persuading the Continental Congress to give him money.
That's right, persuaded the Continental Congress to give him money, and then he persuaded his troops to stay and fight when sometimes their terms were up and they wanted to go home. That is one of the great things that he did, was to hold the Continental Army together after they got it raised.
What was his appeal? What was the nature of his appeal? How did he manage to persuade them? By sheer personal force and personality?
I think so. But he was considered the honorable man of the period. Washington's word was better than most men's bonds. And when he told the people what he thought and why he thought it, they believed him and went along with him. I'm sure that, as I sit here, if you read some of the contacts that he had with his troops and the contacts that he had on these tours around over the states, you'll find that he knew how to present his policies and what he wanted to do as well as any politician that ever lived.
Did he induce respect in a sense of leadership, or was there also an affection, or kind of a warm thing?
They were both. The affection was there because he had succeeded in holding the colonies together and winning the freedom for the United States of America. And then it seems that every person who served with him was exceedingly fond of him, and he must have been a kindly man as well as a tough one.
President, how do you agree? How do you account for his very long and formal style of writing? Did that arise out of his character or something?
No, I think that was the customary style of the day. And they all followed through on that. And the historical records, some of them that I have seen, are to the effect that when he wrote a message to the Congress, every one of his cabinet made a contribution to it. And he discussed with the members of Congress the things that he wanted to do, and sometimes inserted a paragraph or two that somebody in the Congress had suggested to him, which is what we all do when we have to.
Well, he was very affectionate and very warm with his family, and his separation from his wife during the Revolutionary period was a great burden to him, was it not?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. He was a very great. He was a great family man, and he adopted the two children of Mrs. Washington.
But they wrote long sentences in those days and spoke short ones.
That's right. Sometimes they used the long ones in their speeches too. Read some old Daniel Webster speeches if you don't believe that.
Well, they got not only flowery, but stuffy and sometimes not very easily understood.
They had a system of what they call polite correspondence. And people were taught how to write letters and how to address them and how to close them up. And there was a great deal of flowery language involved in those things, and that crept into some of the messages of George Washington. We've got his messages there in the library, all of them.
Would you say that he caught very early the very essence and future of the United States that would have held even to this day, that he he understood the role and the goals of the United States as a government?
There isn't any question about that, because he was a member of the Continental Congress at the time of its organization. And when they called this Constitutional Convention together, of course, they made him the chairman. He was the man to be the chairman, because he knew somebody in every colony and was associated with the men who were at the top of the government in every colony.
Well, then how do you account, Mr. President, for his vision of isolationism and his interpretation of the alliance with England as a defensive one, enough to get him into war with France?
It was just good common sense on his part. At that time, 3 million people scattered from Maine to the southern boundary of Georgia were not in a position to become a loud voice in world affairs. The two governments at that time that were controlling world affairs were France and England, and they were at each other's throats. Part of the time, during the Napoleonic period, it looked very much as if France would have the absolute control of all Europe and wipe Britain out. It didn't happen, though, because the British controlled the sea. Washington was trying to reach a balance between those two governments so as to protect the new government of the United States. And he thought the less they meddled in the foreign affairs of Europe, and that's all they looked at, the foreign affairs of Europe, the better off they'd be. And that was true at that time.
And
but
that was,
we outgrew it.
And that was actually, therefore, a measure for the moment rather than a policy to be followed.
It was a policy for the salvation of the government of the United States at that time, because Britain or France, either one, would have taken it over if they thought they had a good chance to do it.
You mentioned Britain and France. What about Spain? Spain was a major power.
Spain was then on the downgrade. The Spanish government began its downgrade when the Spanish Armada was wiped out by Sir Francis Drake, and he never recovered from it. And from then on, the Spanish power in the world, Spain was controlled entirely by Napoleon during the height of his business, so the two powers that really counted were Britain and France.
Now, do you know of any moments of disillusionment or discouragement on the part of George Washington during the presidency?
Oh, yes. When he was viciously attacked by the press at that time, it worried him and made him feel very badly. In fact, one time he threatened to resign the presidency, and when the second period came along for the second administration, they had to do a lot of persuading to get him to do it, because he'd been so viciously attacked publicly. He didn't like it very much, because as a general of the Continental Armies, he didn't do that.
Well, now, it was his problem with the people, or was it with the press, or with the politicians? Now,
it was his problem was with the press principally. He didn't have any trouble with the outstanding politicians of that day, because they had all served under him, they all liked him, they all thought he was all right. But when he put forth the policy, of course there was opposition. Jefferson opposed some of his policies, which he had a perfect right to do, and that's one of the reasons he quit the cabinet.
Why was he so viciously attacked in the press by the nephew of Benjamin Franklin? I can't recall his name now, but
he was the bastard son of Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, I see.
That's why. And he was a royalist. He stayed with the British. That was one of the heartbreaks for old Franklin. He raised that boy and thought the world and all of him. I don't know what his name for Franklin, I'm not sure. And he became one of the officials, British officials in, I think, New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken. And then did everything he possibly could to keep the colonies from becoming a free government. But I don't know exactly why he did it, but it was a heartbreak to Benjamin Franklin. You never see him mentioned in Franklin's memoirs at all.
Yes, he was constantly attacking him, and when Washington resigned, he wrote the most scurrilous article preserved today, saying, "Thank God the monarchy is gone."
That's right, that's right.
And a corrupt monarch.
That's right. That's and that came out in all those papers that time.
Was John Roosevelt of his day.
That's right.
Okay, I don't share that. He was also accused of overdrawing his pay as president, wasn't he?
I don't think he ever took any pay as president. He never took his pay, I'm sure of that. He never did take any pay as president. He took expense money whenever he out anything in the interest of the government. By
he never got paid as president.
He didn't take his pay as president. You find that's historically correct. That's
nevertheless, he was accused by the scurrilous papers of overdrawing his pay.
That's what was the matter. So many false accusations against him, and that is one of them.
What was the dominant theme? What is the substance of all the attacks on him? What is it about him they didn't like?
Because he was president of the United States. That's customary. Whenever a fellow's in power, it doesn't make any difference who he is. You see, the establishment of freedom of the press in this country was a precedent that had never been done before. And these editors and publishers of that day, they were small men compared to what we have now, went haywire on the subject. They worked it to death and would have been suppressed under ordinary conditions. But Washington and Hamilton and Jefferson believed in a free press. Jefferson, I think, made the statement that he might not agree with what they had to say about him or about anybody else, but he wouldn't go forego to make that statement that wiped out so they couldn't do it. That's not the word they used.
But that was the spirit of it now.
And that's the reason that it was not a press that was established. There were a lot of people just like this Franklin boy who turn loose their venom which they had against somebody else on the man in power and so on.
Well, who introduced the idea of a free press? Which one of those men?
I think it was Jefferson.
Jefferson.
I think it was
Jefferson. And Washington went along with it.
Oh, yes. The Continental Congress, I think, passed a resolution to that effect long before the government of the United States was established.
When the colonies were still...
Still colonies.
There was a free press in the United States.
They made an effort to have one. I don't think they ever did have a free press, but they made an effort to have one to give the people a chance to express themselves. But today, now, we've got a publisher's press. We haven't got a free press. I'd say in the 40s, 50s, 60s, up until probably 1889, the papers were operated by the editors who wrote the editorials. And they didn't hire people to write for them like they do today. And they had their own opinions, and they fought with each other just as much as they did the government. So that was a free press.
Well, were they influential, effective?
Yes, to some extent they were.
What part of the country was pretty much controlled by the opinions expressed in the press?
Well, in Lincoln's period, it was the papers in New York, Horace Greeley's paper, and Dana's paper, and George James Gordon Penn's paper were the influence of the press of that day.
They were influential beyond their circulation, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
Matter of fact, when Washington retired as president, I recall reading a letter in which he wrote someone who inquired about whether he was keeping up with the news, and Washington wrote that he didn't intend to keep up with the news because he could only get it through the newspapers, and he didn't intend to subscribe or read any of it.
That's what he said, and that's because they viciously attacked him, you know. But he kept up just the same. He had a voluminous correspondence. You've got to see the volumes of his letters and the people that he corresponded with. And that's where they get the character from, is why he expressed himself just as with the other great men of that day. Their correspondents outlined the character under which they were.
Did he write his letters longhand, all of them?
Yes, yes, they're all written in longhand.
They didn't? Did the secretaries write letters for him, or did he do all his own?
I've never seen one written for him by a secretary. Probably his messages and things of that kind were written by a secretary, and he signed them, but his individual correspondence were longhand letters he wrote himself. How he ever got the time to do it?
That's what I was going to ask you. Where in the world did he get the time
Jefferson
to do it?
In the same way. You find a letter from Jefferson's to John Adams in which he said he was a slave to his writing table, that he never could keep up with his correspondence.
Well, now, that's a burden that's almost unendurable in itself. This has been spared the later presidents. They don't have to at least occupy themselves. They dictate the few personal ones, but the rest of it is delegated.
That's true.
Except that they have a greater volume of correspondence to deal with now.
Oh, yes. The correspondence of the president is fantastic. It's just been 1,000 letters a day at the White House.
President, this is the end of tape for September 17th.
The end of this trip.
What the last one start in the go now? I just want to see if it works all right.
We did Washington, didn't we?
What?
We did Washington before, huh?
Yeah. President, this is tape number one on the glorious day of October the 5th. President, Noyes Hillman, President. Now, Mr. President, we want to start in again to go on front Washington. And Dave, I think you have some questions.
Well, we, in all of these, we're trying to get a fresh, uncontaminated, and crystal clear view of these people as seen through your own knowledge of history and through your own judgment about these men in light of your own experience with the presidency. We've done a little bit of George Washington. We may come back, but let's go on and talk about John Adams.
Well, I think that's an interesting approach that we're trying to make. We're trying to get on the record an impression of one president about those who have preceded him in a manner that will do them justice and at the same time give a viewpoint that's never been given before.
Go ahead, Mr. President.
Yes,
you were going to talk about Adams, the second president.
John Adams was quite a man, but his idea of government was for a special coterie of people who in those days were considered better than the general run of the population. That's where the argument between Jefferson and Adams took place. They then, after long years afterward, carried on a correspondence, and each of them became a very great admirer of the other, because they each of them respected the views of the other man, but didn't agree with him necessarily, politically or otherwise.
What made John Adams effective as a president?
Well, I'm not so sure that he was effective as a president. He had Thomas Jefferson for a vice president, and while Thomas Jefferson was vice president under Adams, he wrote the program that's known as the Jefferson Manual for the operation of legislative bodies in the United States, and it's been a guide by which all the organizations in the country have gone. It's also the progenitor of Robert's Rules of Order for any sort of a meeting. Adams was a man who believed that the welfare of the country was best served by people who had a situation in the world above the ordinary run of the population. And he and Alexander Hamilton were in complete agreement as to how the government of the United States ought to be run. Jefferson was not in agreement with them. He trusted the ordinary common people. Adams and Secretary of the Treasury under Washington.
Hamilton.
Alexander Hamilton did not agree with Jefferson in his viewpoint. And that difference of opinion continued until the time of Jackson, but was more plainly set out by Jackson, and that was the foundation of the differences between the two parties that we have now, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
In many ways, then, Adams did agree and carry out the policies of George Washington.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that he agreed and carried out entirely the policies of George Washington. He agreed and carried out the policies of Alexander Hamilton, who didn't have really the inside track with Washington. Washington listened to all his cabinet, of which Jefferson was one.
Well, how would you characterize Adams as a man, as a...
I think he was an honorable and upright man, and that he did the best he could according to his own beliefs and program. I don't think there was anything underhand about John Adams. He was an upstanding character of his time, but his political ideas are not in agreement with those of Jefferson, in which I believe, of course. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Adams was in any way not an honest and honorable and upright man.
But he was more property-minded than he was human-minded. Would you say that's...
Well, I think he was no doubt property-minded, but then, you see, John Adams had been one of the foreign service officers under the Continental Congress. He'd been to all the countries of Europe, and his son, John Quincy Adams, was raised principally out of this country. And they came in contact with people in Russia and in Holland, when Holland was at the height of its power, and Great Britain and France. And they had a very different idea from those people who had grown up in the colonies under the British rule. You see, Jefferson, as governor of Virginia, had inaugurated some of the great policies which are included in the Constitution of the United States, and so had the people who organized the government of New York. New York's Constitution was the model on which the Constitution of the United States was written. And the Constitution of the United States contains many provisions that were in the Constitution of the state of New York. So Adams was out of the country most of the time while all these things were developing. And he had obtained in his associations in Europe ideas which were not exactly the proper ideas, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Jefferson's opinion, with which I agree, that there was a certain way that government ought to be run for the benefit of a certain class who knew more about what ought to be good for the people than the people themselves knew. That's the difference between Jefferson and Adams.
From a aristocracy.
Well, Mr. President, let me ask you this. Adams was, however, a brilliantly educated man, wasn't he? Who set a certain tradition in America and in American history.
There's no doubt about that. He was an honorable, upright, and a highly educated man, and an honest man. That's the principal thing about him.
But your point is that he was exposed to conservative views while he was traveling abroad, and he was influenced by those contacts.
I think that's true. While he was a strong advocate of freedom from England and did everything he possibly could to help free the country from England, he still had those views in the back of his head that he thought that there ought to be a ruling class in the country, with which some of us have never agreed.
How do you rate him as an administrator and as an administrative president?
Well, he wasn't there long enough to come into the operation of the government of the United States as we now think it should have been carried out, have been his program were not inaugurated by him, because I think the principal reason, I think they have time to do it. People got tired of him before he had a chance to have him, before he had another turn.
Well, you're now saying that he could not have accomplished it. He could not end one term, and that one term is too brief a period for a president?
Well, usually it's too brief for the simple reason that there are two congresses in the one term of a president. He usually gets acquainted with the congress at that time, and then in an effort to get his program through, he usually runs for office again and tries to get him through in the next two sessions of Congress, which most of the time he's successful in doing. There's only been one president who got his program through in one term, and that was James K. Polk.
What were his relations with the Congress?
I think they were cordial. I don't think he had any troubles with the Congress that I can discover. Well, the people of the country thought he was an aristocrat and a high hat, and that's the reason Jefferson was able to win in 1900.
How did he keep in touch with the country in those days?
I don't think he did. I think that's what the trouble was.
Was there any way that he could keep the public informed of his policies in those days?
It was a very difficult matter in those days for our president to keep the country fully informed. There were newspapers scattered around over the country, but the means of communication were very difficult for the simple reason that most of the correspondence was carried on by stagecoach. That was before the invention of the telegraph by Samuel F. B. Morse, and there was no way for, for Virginia and Massachusetts to find out what had taken place except after 4 or 5 days or maybe a week's time had passed, and that made it very difficult in those days to figure out just exactly what the policy of the president is.
Well, Mr. President, then, there's nothing really outstanding during the Adams administration which would emphasize anything about Adams's character beyond what you said now.
No, I think Adams's character is more thoroughly and completely emphasized in the correspondence between Adams and Jefferson long after each of them had been president. And there's another thing in connection with that situation that's of very great importance. The idea of the difference of opinion between the people who believed in special privilege, and that was the idea of John Adams and the Secretary of the Treasury. The difficulty was that they believed that there ought to be a ruling class. Jefferson didn't believe that. He thought the common people were to be trusted. And the ideas developed during that period between those two schools of thought is what has made this country great.
I'm surprised that may I just seem to intrude here. I'm rather amazed by what one American historian says here about is the philosophy of the Jeffersonian. He said that with the election of Jefferson in 1800, he said there was no revolution. For despite their espousal of democracy and their belief in the improvability of man, the Jeffersonians were not ready to turn the government over to the people. Until the masses could be educated for their new responsibility, Jefferson felt rule must be entrusted to the agrarian upper class whose interests paralleled those of the small farmers making up the bulk of the population. Hence, the sole effect of the election of Jefferson was to shift control from the mercantile aristocracy of the Northeast to the agrarian aristocracy of the South and West.
I'm not sure that's a correct analysis of the situation. I think Jefferson had absolute confidence in the ordinary man, when the ordinary man had the information that was necessary to have him make up his mind. That was Jefferson's approach and idea. I don't think it had anything to do with an agrarian aristocracy at all.
Well, just one more. He goes on to say, yet Jefferson's faith in the perfectibility of mankind, his insistence on strong local government to check monarchical trends in the national government, and his belief that each generation should remake its laws and constitutions proved a stimulus to democracy.
I don't think there's any doubt about that statement. I think that's correct.
We get back to President Adams now, because the thing that seems to accentuate Adams's attitude after his retirement, the violent outburst of bitterness. He seemed to have been very bitter about having been deprived of a second term.
He was sorely disappointed, of course. And he was so sorely disappointed that he left the White House at midnight, and he's the first resident the White House ever had. So he would not have to ride to the inauguration of the succeeding president in the same carriage.
Well, he seems to have felt libeled by many members of Congress, particularly those of the southern and middle western states.
Isn't any doubt what it was? Ever present is, so that wasn't anything new. That was just the start of it, and people hadn't learned to understand it as yet.
That's the end of tape on, Mr. President, October 5th.